You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
Shouldn't you be at work?
When the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
I'll have a low-fat pizza or something like that, or a few biscuits and some milk on a Sunday.
And you can pair up if you like, and you can fucking pick someone else to help you, and you can bring your fucking dinner.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Tony Hatton!
No!
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? It's Series 9. It's Episode 5. I'm Chris Skull. Joining me, as always, Josh Widdicombe's here.
Hello.
And here's a man who would never be invited on Dean Holdsworth's stag do in a million years. It's Michael Mod.
Hello.
If you got the invite in the post, would you go?
Yeah, of course.
Yes,
of course.
But out of the blue, if you didn't even know Dean Holdsworth.
Yeah. Yes, but I'd be fucking terrified. I'd go, because you'd have to go if I was free. I wouldn't cancel anything else. But I would not be looking forward to it in any way. And I'd definitely have a drink before I arrived.
You wouldn't cancel? There must be some level of social engagement that you would cancel to go on Dean Holdsworth's
stag. Yeah, Neil Ardley's stag. On the topic of my friend Mark Lamar, he did reply to our tweet, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. So we tweeted out so many unanswered questions, and someone tagged him in, and he said they wouldn't be unanswered if I told you, or something like that.
Yeah, so the mystery continues. It rolls along.
The mystery continues. A couple of people going, genuinely quite angry that we are surprised by this, because they're going, 90s was the time when showbiz and football intersected, and you're like, yeah, I buy that, but watch the documentary. They're two very different worlds, aren't they?
Yeah, I just thought to myself then, was the 90s that random? Were random collections of people hanging out together? And the first thing I thought of was Jerry Halliwell and Nelson Mandela. So, yes.
Yeah, but Jerry Halliwell and Nelson Mandela were hanging out in a prearranged photo shoot. Yeah. Mark Lamar, Jerry Halliwell didn't go on Nelson Mandela's stag do. If she had under the radar, if you were watching,
she should be on Winnie's hen. Should be on Winnie's hen.
Well, you know, I think that's she's quite a discredited person these days.
What, Jerry Halliwell?
Lovely.
Since she married Christian Horner.
I'm just not into Formula One. If you were watching a documentary about Nelson Mandela, and apropos of nothing, a social engagement turned up with him and Jerry Halliwell, I think that would be more surprising. So, Chris, have you got any 90s o'clock news?
Yes, I have.
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10, with Chris Skull.
Our top story today, Michael knocked from the Meat Management Awards.
No.
And more Shilton penalty saves emerge. I've sprung this on you, Michael, but I think we need to talk about it. This is your story. On the 90s Clock News, I'm now passing over to our roving reporter who's on the scene.
So, yeah, a couple of episodes ago, I think, we found out that Kevin Keegan was hosting the Meat Management Awards, and I said on the show, and I can't remember whether this made the edit in the end or not, because... Well, you'll find out why. I said I was gonna go, basically. So immediately after that recording, I booked a ticket for the Meat Management Awards. I think somewhere in the region of £200. Booked a train ticket to Birmingham. Booked a hotel in the hotel that it was hosted at for sort of ease.
and then roll back into bed at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Stinking a barbecue.
Covered in offal. And I obviously put it on the group that I was going. It's like, so excited. This is the best thing that's ever going to happen. And then the next day I had a missed call from someone at the Meat Management Awards. And it was an answer phone message. And it was like, hello, Mr. Marden, this is so-and-so.
Terry McDermott.
From the Meat Management Awards. We just wanted to get in touch about your ticket. I was like, oh, that's weird. I'm not answering that. Absolutely not. And then about 2 hours later, I got an email saying, yeah, hi there. We're terribly sorry, but the event is sold out, so we won't be able to honour your ticket. And then it was cancelled. Now, I smell a rat here because, A...
A barbecue rat.
I don't think...
On a little rotisserie.
I don't think the Meat Management Awards is or was sold out. I don't believe it. I know Kevin Keegan's got some pull. I think they know, because it's Kevin Keegan, they're going to bring some people in that aren't part of the Meat Management Awards and they don't want that crowd. So I think she's checked and looked, because I had to put like the business name and that you were
going for.
Well,
do you know what the first flag of it is? No one's going to the Meat Management Awards.
On their own. Yeah, I thought that.
You needed to book a table. Do you know what I mean? You're not nominated. Yeah. And you're going solo.
Well, I thought about reapplying the next day under a different name, but buying a whole table just to see if it was still available and whether it was a lie or a ruse on their part. But I think they've probably got wind that people who aren't part of the Meat Management aren't be coming along, and they just don't want that crowd.
They've got your fact. They've given you a picture of you to the bouncer and said, do not admit this man, even if he's dressed as a butcher.
So sadly, there is no on-location report from...
Well, if you are part of the meat industry, how do you sleep at night? No, if you are part of the meat industry, then tell us if you're going, and do report back. We'd love
to
know.
Well, it's happened on September.
Well, if you were part of the meeting, right, if you still are part, but you went, then do tell us. I just think these things are happening all the time. I'm surprised this has blown up. I think football managers like Kevin Keegan are doing corporate events all the time that we don't know about. It's just we've stumbled on this. So if anyone else is aware of any of these events hosted by Keegan or his ilk, please do let us know, because we'd love to try and go along.
And congratulations to the co-op for winning best bacon product for their maple cure streaky bacon. Well done.
Well done. Well done.
In other news, thank you to Stu's footy flashbacks. He's contacted me on Twitter to say he's unearthed 5 more penalty saves from Shilton over the 80s and 90s.
What?
For a collection of football clubs, including Southampton, Derby, and the mighty Plymouth Argyle.
Wow.
I just sent you the link.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because, and I'm not someone who wants to come in defence of Shilton, but someone sent us a video, a Derby fan, of Shilton saving 2 penalties from Dwight York in the same match.
What? Have a look at some of these saves. They're acrobatic saves. The second one, which I think against QPR at Loftus Road.
Oh, that's a great penalty save.
He seems to be getting...
Oh. Are we going to have to swallow our words?
That's sensational.
That first one's one of the greatest penalty saves I've ever seen. That second
one, he seems to be guessing as well. He seems to guess.
Yeah, he does seem to go early on that second one.
Yeah.
Oh, great penalty save, the third one.
Do we need to issue an apology?
Oh, this is Plymouth. He's in Plymouth shirt. I don't know where we are. Never seen that ground before.
Look at that. He saved a couple for Plymouth.
Oh, that was a terrible penalty. That power is at West Brom. That penalty is what people would say is an easy height. Every one of his penalty saves is brilliant.
Yeah, what does this mean?
Well, what it means is, because he's guessed right, because he's following the ball, he's always at full stretch. Do you know what I mean? It's never one of those penalty saves where the goalie kind of gets there early and saves it. So it always looks spectacular. What does this mean?
We might have to revise our opinion.
Do you want an email that says, in defence of Peter Shilton? Wayne Lloyd Smith. Dear Quickly Kevin, as a long-time listener and XJ8 member, after recent claims that Peter Shilton was never any good for England, I wanted to offer something of a reprieve for him from a footballing perspective. At the climax of the 1990 World Cup qualifiers in autumn 1989, England needed at least a draw away in Poland to qualify for the World Cup. Otherwise, they would have left themselves open to dropping out of the qualifying spots based on one second place team not qualifying, which turned out to be Denmark. In the game, Shilton turned out a man of the match performance with several good saves that ensured England gained the draw they needed to qualify for the 1990 World Cup. Without that man of the match performance, England would not have qualified for the World Cup in 1990. English football would probably not have had the revival it experienced in the early 90s, leading to the creation of the Premier League, and the amazing time we all know and love today. Without that, would the Quickly Kevin podcast even exist? I know, I shudder at the thought. This isn't actually Peter Shilton trying to justify his footballing existence, I promise. All the best, lads. Wayne Lloyd-Smith. Absolutely fascinating.
That is, wow. That is our equivalent of finding out that Darth Vader is your father in The Empire Strikes Back.
Exactly. It really is, isn't it? That is amazing.
Wow, mind-blowing.
Well, we all know that this week also Peter Shilton tweeted out a tweet.
Oh, we've got to talk about this.
We've got to talk about this. Are you aware of this, Michael? Yeah. Peter Shilton tweeted out, happy birthday to my husband, Peter Shilton. Is that right?
Happy birthday to my wonderful husband, at Peter Shilton, who I absolutely adore. And that's from the account of Peter Shilton. Sensational.
Oh, well, sensational stuff. We've all done it. I know I've tweeted out a picture of Stan Flashman from my main Instagram account and deleted it very swiftly.
Oh, I wanted that. Well, I kind of want that to happen. Just the total bewilderment of the majority of your followers.
Well, I'm happy to. Why don't I, on Friday, when this is out on the. So it's before the show's come out on the main feed. This is for XJ8 listeners only. I'll tweet out a picture of Stan Flashman. I'll Instagram it out. On the grid? I mean, on the grid is a bit much, isn't it?
It's a big move.
Yeah,
big
on the grid.
Do you know what we should do?
On the grid. And what should the caption be?
21 stone Stan Flashman.
No, I'm not doing that. I'll get number body shaming. Just the caption will just be Stan Flashman.
We should... you remember when they were marketing Fire Festival? Firefest, and yeah. They sort of overtook social media with like an orange square that they got all the influencers to post.
Oh yeah,
we should mobilize the Quickly Kevin audience, and at a set time and date, everyone that listens to this show has preloaded the same picture of Stan Flashman.
Oh yeah,
and then we just firebomb Instagram with this same picture.
Let's do that. A flash mob.
Flashman mob.
Flashman mob. So when will we do our Flashman mob?
I think we need to have given everyone a chance to have listened to this episode. So it should probably be like 3 or 4 days after the general release. So like maybe Thursday.
Thursday at midday.
Thursday at midday.
And it'll be the Flashman picture that I put up this Friday.
Yeah.
With just the caption Stan Flashman.
Yeah, so okay. Every Quickly Kevin listener, we expect you to do your duty.
Could we get it trending? Could we get Stan Flashman trending?
Yes, let's do it. Hashtag Stan Flashman.
So put it on your Twitter as well.
Swarm your social media with Stan Flashman.
12 p.m. Thursday.
Put it in your diary now.
Yeah, I have done. I've written it down with a Sharpie of all things, so it really is staying
and
there.
And as an extra incentive, I will be searching that hashtag, and I will be giving away some Quickly Kevin merch to anyone that does it randomly.
Lovely.
So get involved.
We'll put the picture up. I'll put it on my Instagram. We'll also put it on our Quickly Kevin Instagram, which is what?
Instagram.com/QuicklyKevin.
There we go, to get the picture. So there we go. Right, now, electronic postbag.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
We did have an email, and it does come into my head now every time, saying that they love Jim Rosenthal, but it annoys them every time that he calls it the electronic postbag.
What should it be called?
The electronic postbag.
Oh, come on.
That's almost as bad as the grief I get for pronouncing it Ballon d'Or instead of Blondor.
Ballon d'Or, do you say?
Ballon d'Or. Ballon d'Or. It's got an apostrophe in it. Just because I speak English.
What's the singer, Skull, who sang Sign Your Name Across My Heart? Terence Trent.
D'Arby.
Do you call him Terence Trent D'Arby?
I've always called him Terence Trent D'Arby. I've been consistent in that.
Right, so... Shall we start with a Do I Remember This Right?
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 Do I Remember This Right? Right.
We don't get them as much as you used to, do you? But they're still good when you get them. This is from Thomas Morley. My email is adoIRememberThisRight, although potentially only one listener will be able to confirm whether this is the case. Whilst at school in the mid-90s, I recall being fascinated by a boy in the year above me, who, it was rumoured, played Championship Manager in real time.
Wow. I kind of love that. I really love this.
I.e., he'd play...
Oh, God, this is brilliant.
I was laughing so much when I read this, the thought of it.
So many questions. I have so many questions already.
Oh, well, i.e., he'd play one day in the game per actual day. It was also said that he managed to align the days to real life. So he'd play out the 15th of December in the game on the 15th of December in real life. I found this concept both inspiring and bizarre, and always wondered how many unexplored areas of the game he was able to plumb with such enormous amounts of time on his hands. Match days must have been particularly intense, as a painful loss would have been felt not for the 5 minutes, but the entire week until the next game.
Oh, I love it. That's like, you know how people would do the team talks in the mirror and wear a suit? That is next level. And also, I want to believe that he is waiting until the time of day of the kickoff on the game, so he can only play the match at 3 p.m. on a Saturday.
7:45 on a Tuesday.
Also, the match speed, 100% is really slow.
Do you know what? Presumably, he watched the matches at the slowest possible setting to prolong the experience, and hence would have spent many hours on tent-hooks as his striker rounded the keeper, only to shoot inexplicably wide. I was never able to confirm these rumours whilst at school, as I didn't know the boy, and his myth had become so legendary to me that I was afraid, if untrue, I'd be crushed by disappointment. Hence, I never dared ask him directly. However, given his clear obsession with 90s football, I strongly suspect he listens to this podcast. His name was Rob Dale, and he went to Bungay High School in Suffolk, B-U-N-G-A-Y, High School in Suffolk. If Rob is a listener, could he please confirm via the show whether the rumours were true? Thanks for your service, Tom in Sheffield.
Is that a Do I Remember This Right directed at a single person? Fantastic.
Yeah. He adds, PS, did you know there's a town in Suffolk called Colton Colville?
Yes.
You did know that. Of course you did.
Of course Carl knew that.
Here's how I found out about that. Colton Cole told me.
Yeah, of course he did.
I said, you're chatting shit. And then he showed me. It's true.
Well, there you go. Now, Skull, are we talking about Roberto Baggio this week?
Yes. It's time for Roberto Baggio with shit.
Roberto Baggio, the saviour of Italy throughout this tournament. He's missed it! And Brazil win the World Cup. Shit!
Thank you. I mean, tons of backup here, including this one email from Simeon Cunningham. He said this, another thought occurred to him this morning. He says, and it may spark Chris's belief that Baggio was overrated. Just have a look at the difference between Costa Curta's trophy haul compared to Baggio's. It is insane. Okay, you ready?
Yep.
Okay, we'll go to that charlatan Baggio first. Club honours, two Serie A trophies, one Coppa Italia, UEFA Cup. That's finished.
Ballon d'Or.
Costa Curta. Seven Serie A. Seven Serie A. One Coppa Italia. Five Super Coppa Italianas. Five Champions League / European Cups.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Four UEFA Super Cups. Two Intercontinental Cups. And UEFA Golden Jubilee Pole number 50. I don't know what that means. But he also finished runner-up in the World Cup in 1994. And he would have won it. He would have won it, of course, if Baggio was any good.
So should I be his defence barrister each time for these things?
Come on then.
Well,
I mean, how can you defend the indefensible?
Well, firstly, Costa Curta was a mainstay in the defence of the most successful Italian team of the 90s and 80s. The AC Milan team were unplayable for years and years and years, whereas Baggio was a nomadic player. But also, Phil Neville's trophy haul compared to Gazza's is ridiculous. Like, that isn't a fair comparison on whether the individual player was great or not.
Oh, for God's sake. It's always an excuse, isn't it, with Baggio? That really just sums up his whole career, isn't it? There's always, but what about this? No, but he's rubbish.
Right. Steve Booth writes, hi all, XJ8 member here. Go to patreon.com/quicklykevin if you'd like to join for much, much more content. It was very, very, very difficult to score goals in Serie A in the early 90s.
Yes, very good point.
That's why when goals were scored, they were often spectacular and often scored by exceptional players like Brolin, who we discussed last week, and Baggio. This will blow your mind. Milan won their third successive Scudetto in 1994 with 36 goals.
Jesus. How many did they concede?
I don't know. It doesn't go into that. That is mad, isn't it? They scored 36 goals all season and won the league.
What season was that? 1994.
Presumably, Chris thinks that they're a worse team than Swindon, who scored 47 goals in that season's Premier League.
So that's probably less than a goal a game.
They played 34 games. They scored 36 and conceded 15. There to be fair as well, that is a proper anomaly, because if you have a look at Juventus in second, scored 58, and Sampdoria in third scored 64. You'd have to go down to Roma in seventh, who scored 35, to find someone who scored less. So they scored less goals in the top six and won the league on account of that stingy defence.
So where does that leave you with Baggio? So
where was Baggio then? He's at Juve, is he, in 94? Yeah.
That was the year he won the Ballon d'Or, I think.
Probably scoring 50% as many goals as the entire AC Milan team on his own.
If you want to get in touch with the show, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter @quicklykevin. And sign up to the mailing list @quicklykevin.com.
Before we go on, if you haven't had enough of the 90s, Skull, how can they get a bit more?
Well, listen, guess what? It's taken me 2 years, but I'm happy to reveal I've written a book about 90s football alongside Sid Lambert, who goes by A Funny Old Game on Twitter. It's all about 90s football. There's a chapter in there on managers wearing flat caps. There's a bit about Jack Charlton looking like the farmer from Babe. There's a bit of some research you did around Jimmy Fivebillies eating a mince pie that had been filled with cat shit. Sir Alex Ferguson getting a speeding ticket, getting off a speeding ticket by claiming he had diarrhoea. All this good stuff is contained now within a book.
I can't wait to read this, Carl.
That's called Can We Not Knock It? And guess what? It's available for pre-order from right now if you go to conquereditions.co.uk. And along with the book, if you buy the book right now from conquereditions.co.uk, you're going to get a signed copy. You're going to get your name in the book, and you're going to get a little poem contained within the book as well. So it's called Can We Not Knock It? It's got all kinds of stuff in there, including a playthrough of Terry Venables' The Manager board game. Head on over to conquereditions.co.uk and get your copy of Can We Not Knock It today.
Can I have it without the poem? If you want 90s books, Watching Neighbours Twice a Day is in your bookshops now. Do buy it. I don't want to say this, willy-nilly, but it is a Sunday Times bestseller, only just after Taskmaster was considered a quiz book, so removed from the top 10. Now, how excited are you about this guest?
Is this our first World Cup winner?
I think it is our first World Cup winner, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mainly because we've only interviewed British players so far.
And there's not many World Cup winners knocking around them.
I think what we should do is we'll say this is Andreas Bremer, we'll go into the interview, and then we'll start by telling you how this all came about. This is Quickly Kevin meets Andreas Bremer. So, this all started a couple of months ago when we'd become a bit into Andreas Bremer. He'd become one of our characters that we go to. Now, normally that's because we've decided we have issues with the person, but it's because we kind of decided that he was one of the greatest footballers of the 90s. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd seen that he had written an amusing comment on Gary Lineker's Instagram. So I clicked on his name, chucked him a follow, and it turned out it was the best thing I ever did, because it turned out that Andreas Bremer was brilliant on Instagram. So what you can do with Instagram is you can just message people willy-nilly, even if they're not following you, unlike Twitter. You can DM them. So I sent Andy Bremer a message, and I asked him, I thought it was a punt, messaged him and asked whether he'd fancy doing an interview on Quickly Kevin. And astonishingly, he replied and said he would be interested and to contact his agent. So he contacted his agent, and his agent said he would love to do it, but his English wasn't good enough to do a straight chat with us. Now, Other podcasts, I think, would have been scared off by that. But I think we made the right decision, didn't we? We did discuss, Skull, you momentarily suggested the interpreter route.
Yes, a classic era of the translation game.
Very Transworld sport. Very Transworld sport.
But we thought it would just be too clunky with a translator.
So what we realised we could do is he was willing to answer the questions if he saw them before, if they were sent to him. So we agreed that we would just send Andreas Bremer 15 to 20 questions that we were interested in, and he'd send us back a recording of his thoughts on them. And these are, should we call them the Andy Bremer tapes?
Wiederkowalz. Bremen, kommt sie drauf!
Ja, das war's!
Das ist der Sieg! Das ist das Viertelfinale! Lange hat sich Andy Bremen zurückgehalten, um dann diesen Kunstschuss abzugeben in der 85. Spielminute. Erzielt Andreas Bremer.
So obviously it would be quite mad to just play these tapes of Andy Bremer saying his answers to his agent being recorded. So we thought, to give it a feel of a normal Quickly Kevin, because obviously we weren't in the room, so we weren't having a general conversation with him. We're going to play you bits of what Andy Bremer sent us, and then we'll discuss it as we go along, creating the classic Quickly Kevin vibe. I'm going to say it. I can't believe we've got the scorer of the winning goal in the 1990 World Cup final, Andy Bremer, to do this for us. And what a lovely guy.
Lovely guy. Also, my first note, listen how young he sounds.
He sounds so young.
Sound
young. He's great.
Timeless.
Did you come out of this, like me, in the same way that after interviewing Gary Neville, I was quite pleased that the 1990 Champions League had happened, 1999. After this, I was like, I don't mind Andy Bremer winning the World Cup. I'm quite happy for 1990 to end how it did.
No.
Too far.
Yeah, I would actually say I came out of this a bit emotionally hurt because because of the way he just dismisses the rivalry with England. Like every German we've ever spoken to on here has kind of dismissed it.
We started by saying, hello, Andy, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on the show.
There he is, our big man. And then we decided to ask him, the classic opener of Quickly Kevin, was he the best player when he was at school?
I was good, but there were other kids on my street, of course, who were also amazing footballers. However, when I was young, I trained a lot more than everyone else. I started at Barnbeb Uhlenhorst when I was 6 years old. And my father, who was the coach, was really strict with me. Of course, to other kids, he was very caring and fair, but I got the full package and he always had an eye on me. And that's how he helped me a lot for my career.
Do you buy that Andy Bremer wasn't even the best player on his street, but just worked really
Absolutely
hard?
Absolutely not. Like, I find that...
Really?
I find that baffling. What fucking street did he live on if he's not the... Like, this guy scored the winning goal at the World Cup final, played for, like, one of the best Italian teams in the history of football. Did he live on the same street as Pelé? Like, I found that absolutely insane. The fact that he's like, yeah, but I just trained a bit harder. Because that sort of makes a mockery of the fact that, oh, well, I probably could have made it then if I just trained a bit harder. It's like, come on, Andy.
Well, I subscribe to that. That's actually, I thought, because remember when Harry Redknapp talked about Frank Lampard, he's like, he was just famously just trained and trained and trained and made himself great. And I think there is something to that.
I'm not disputing the training thing. The application, you know, Gary Neville is a prime example of that, David Beckham. But the idea that there's a sort of, I'm picturing like a terraced street somewhere in Germany, and there's all these kids just kicking a ball around against a brick wall. And there's Andreas Bremer, like the sixth or seventh best kid. There is absolutely no way. And the best player that I ever played with on the Isle of Wight growing up was 10 times better than anyone else, like just was unplayable, and he never made it to the Premier League. So the idea that there are better players than Andreas Bremer as a sort of kid or a teenager is like, let alone one, but multiples, just on his street.
The best left back of our lives.
not even in his town, on his street.
What do you think about Andreas having his dad as his coach? And it's a classic story of the dad is always harsher on their own kid.
Yeah.
To like not show favoritism, I suppose it is, but also to work them harder. I suppose he was annoyed at Andreas because he wasn't the best player on the street.
God, I wish Klaus over at number four was my son.
I mean, that's going to drive you on, isn't it?
Well, this was the thing about Andy Bramer, is that he did have 1 in 8 talent that no other footballer really has, which is that he was completely ambidextrous with his feet, which is what we asked him about next.
Yeah, and just before we go to that clip, is every other kid on his street ambidextrous as well? Like, how fucking good are these kids on his street, and why are none of them professional footballers? This guy can play equally as well with both feet, and he's still not the best footballer on his street. It's madness.
It was always, I would say, natural. I can write only with my right hand. But with my feet, it was always absolutely the same. At penalties, it was just as a decision of my instinct and feeling. Maybe 1 minute before I took the penalty, I would go with my feeling and pick whichever foot to use.
I mean, it must be mad. It's weird that it's not more regular, actually, isn't it?
What, that playing with both feet?
Yeah.
I guess the thing that really marks him out is that there's lots, I mean, to be a professional footballer, you've got to be good with both feet, but to genuinely not have a favourite.
Yeah.
That's what kind of blows my mind. Like, how could you never have your weaker foot?
To take a penalty and just feel which one fancies it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, even Ronnie O'Sullivan would be your kind of touch point, right, for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he plays right-handed and then he goes left-handed if he's in a position where it'd be easier, or if he dislikes his opponent and is showing off to annoy them when he's clearing up.
Yeah.
Basically, that's the situation. Yeah.
But I'd wager that if Ronnie O'Sullivan played an entire tournament with his less preferred hand, you'd notice a drop in quality over the course of like shots.
Yeah.
I don't think he's equally as good. But essentially,
no.
Andreas Bramer is as good. Like, you wouldn't notice the difference.
Yeah. Does it happen in other sports? Is Andreas Bramer one of the only people in any sport? It'd be amazing in tennis, wouldn't it? If there was one player that only ever had to play forehands, because whatever side it was, they just passed the racket from right to left hand to just keep it on the forehand.
I was just trying to think, like, other sports where it might be advantageous to have both hands. I was thinking, like, darts. There's no advantage.
Advantage in darts.
That's no, it's stupid.
The strange thing about it is, the weird thing people pick out is that you take a penalty with either foot. And that's one of the few things where it's absolutely no advantage.
Yeah.
Unless you're running up and they don't know which foot you're hitting with. Even then, corners is more an advantage because you can always hit in swingers, I suppose.
Yeah. And free kicks as well, I guess, depending on the position. You're essentially the first choice for every single free kick. But it's I can understand that because that's almost like a kind of special place thing. I think you could train yourself to take free kicks well with your other foot. But in the flow of a game, on the pitch, in the moment, there not being a preference either way. Or, you know, he could pick either way and there'd be no difference in the quality of his first touch or his pass or any of that. It's just mind-blowing.
It's really amazing. And it's kind of, we've had emails in about other players that maybe take a corner with either foot or stuff. But these aren't players who are playing at literally the highest level with both feet. And Franz Beckenbauer is saying they don't know which foot is their better to play with. To give you an idea of the other people we've had in, the two suggested by James Guyon for players that took penalties with both feet, the two players in the Premier League history to score penalties with both feet, anyone? Obafemi Martins and Bobby Zamora.
Wow.
There you go. You must have met Bobby Zamora, haven't you, Scott?
I met him recently, yeah.
Next time you meet him, ask him about his two-foot thing, yeah?
What's this two-foot thing I hear about?
This both-footed thing. Yeah, I think it is the kind of thing that marks Andreas Bramer out as one of the great footballers of our lifetime. He's got like a special thing that no one else has got. Yeah. So then we come on to ask him about the best moment of his career, really, domestically, and that is his time at Inter Milan under the manager Giovanni Trapattoni.
Giovanni Trapattoni was a very special chapter. He was incredible and one of the best coaches I've ever worked with. He created the perfect team and spirit, and obviously we were very successful. he spoke to us one-on-one a lot. And after training, we always spent extra time practicing. I played in Bayern, for example, a lot in midfield as well. And it was Trapattoni and Beckenbauer who then moved me to a full-time left back.
Trapattoni. Fascinating that he liked him, because I've always thought Trapattoni was a bit unlikable and that the Baggio film on Netflix cemented that in my mind. But he seemed to love him.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because we remember Trapattoni in the UK and Ireland as the guy who came to manage the Irish team and made them quite shit. Like I suppose in the same way, Capello, his reputation over here probably isn't what it deserves to be.
Yeah.
I kind of regret that I'm slightly, if someone said like, what like bit of the 80s football would you have liked to have witnessed and been a part of? I wish I'd known more about that kind of period of Milan and Inter Milan. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Inter Milan with Jürgen Klinsmann, Lothar Matthäus and Andy Bremer. And you're only allowed three foreigners.
Yeah.
And they've signed those three. That's so exciting, isn't
it? It's fascinating. And I think growing up, it was the Dutch contingent at AC Milan that were the sort of glamour names. You know, everyone had heard of Hullit, Van Basten, Rijkaard. You know, I've still got the little figures, the pro star figures from those guys. But sort of looking into this and around it, you at least didn't realise the kind of scale of what was going on there. These were the two arguably biggest, or two of the biggest teams in Italy at the time, which was the most successful and the best league in the world. And they've signed three players from rival countries for their own teams, creating this sort of like weird ecosystem. It's like Germany versus Holland. It's Milan versus Inter.
In the same stadium.
Like, I think that's unprecedented. There isn't, you know, the closest you'd get to that is if sort of City and United both signed Messi, Aguero and Di Maria. And then United signed, you know, Neymar, Gabriel Jesus, someone else. And then they decided to share a stadium.
And also, on top of that, that's not in addition to your other foreign players. You're only allowed three.
Yeah.
You've chosen them all from the same pool. Do you know what I mean? You've gone, we've got the three best Germans, you've got the three best Dutchmen. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah, it's like a sort of playground game when you're picking your mates off the wall.
I've just got a memory, right, which I should Google. I'm sure this is true. I remember, so Aston Villa, I think it must have been the year after, the year after the World Cup, when I just first got into sport, into football from the Italian 90 World Cup, thanks to Peter Shilton getting England there, and I wouldn't have been into football otherwise. I remember Aston Villa were in the UEFA Cup or something, because Graham Taylor would have just got them to second, right? And they played Inter Milan. And I remember seeing the name. I vividly remember that Inter Milan team having those three German players and me being absolutely blown away that this existed.
Yeah.
And then when you actually, I've just Googled that team. There's so many good players in it, because you've got Walter Zenger in goal. Bergamy is in defence with Bremer and Ferry, who I don't know. And then Matthäus has got Nicola Berti and Serena up front, who was the striker who played for Italy. It's like so exciting that that team existed.
Yeah, back when those sort of the best players domestically very rarely left their home country. Yeah,
the Aston Villa beat them 2-0, and the Aston Villa team contains a forward line of Tony Daly and Tony Cascarino. And a defence of Andy Comyn, who ended up at Plymouth, Derek Mountfield, Kent Nielsen and Chris Price, who I've never heard of. Midfield of Gordon Cowans, Stuart Gray, never heard of him, Paul Birch, who ended up at Exeter City, and David Platt. And they beat that Inter team. Now, we can talk about like Serie A at that point and AC Milan versus Inter, but obviously better that Andy Bremer talks about it.
Serie A at that time was like, I would say, Premier League today. Everybody wanted to play there, and the teams and all matches were on the highest level. Of course, I played several times against Diego in the league, but the toughest striker to play against in my entire career was Ruud Gullit. He was very fast, clever, and nearly unstoppable. He was really like an amazing player. Jürgen only came a year later, but Lothar and I lived even in the same village near Milan. And due to the great team spirit at Inter, I was also hanging around with all my Italian teammates. The Italians helped us a lot, and there was everywhere a warm welcome. Italian football fans have a lot of passion and support you to the end. We all became more or less Italians, and today I feel at least 50% I'm an Italian. At that time, the rivalry AC Milan against Inter was even increased by the German-Dutch element. The derby della Madonnina was like a little Germany versus Holland match. Off pitch, they were great sportsmen, and we had a lot of respect for each other. I still have contact with all three players, and then we meet every time, and then we have always great fun. It is always like coming home when I'm at San Siro.
If ever there's proof that 90s football is an infinite well that we are never going to stop going to, it is that we've never talked about the AC and Inter Milan rivalry. Now, I didn't know this next thing. I don't know who put this question in. Who put this in? But he then almost moved to Barcelona.
Yes, that would have been me. Yeah.
So this is Andy's take on it.
During that time, Barca could only have three foreign players. And in the end, they could not sell one of them. So the deal did not happen. But I ended up at Zaragoza, which was also a fantastic club and time.
So he failed to go to Barcelona because they had three foreigners already.
Yeah, and real echoes of what's happening at Barcelona now, isn't it? Where they've just signed players and it's like, oh, wait, we can't play them all.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what do we do? It's been going on a long time. Bremer blazed that trail.
Exactly.
I don't know. This is my observation of Spanish football from afar, but it just feels like a massive kind of car crash. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one really, it's just bumbling along. Like, people, like, this is like a multi-generational thing there. The Bremer experience, and it still goes on today, where you're just like, God, who knows what they're doing here?
Well, it feels like those two big clubs are so big and so untouchable that at points they just
do what they want.
They just do what they want and get away with it enough that they can just be badly managed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a whiff of the sort of too big to fail about them. But that three player rule, like, is fascinating.
It's mad that it happened, isn't it?
I mean, sort of a question, a hypothetical is, like, were it to come back or were it to be proposed,
that'd be great.
Would A, you want it, and B, what kind of impact do you think it would have on, like, the English national side as a result of all of those players being given chances that they probably wouldn't have been at the top level?
Well, if you told me that a while ago, I'd have gone, yeah. But now it does feel like so many good English players are coming through that it's not as hindering as it felt 3 or 4 years ago. However, it would be hugely thrilling if they announced it and teams had one summer to adapt. Could you imagine the price of English players suddenly go? The premium on having quite a good English player would go through the absolute roof.
Well, it's already quite bad now. Like, imagine how much worse it would get.
And also, if they brought in an Inter and AC Milan rule that you had to have three players from the same country, so you could only pick from one country. So if you wanted in the 90s George Weah, you had to take two other Liberians. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And Ali Dyer counts.
Ali Dyer does count, of course. We then obviously moved on to Bremer's international career. We first asked him about a man we found quite scary, in theory, but he was a big fan of, Franz Beckenbauer.
Franz was not only a player, a genius, but also a fantastic coach. We all had incredible respect to him because he was an idol for us. He treated us always fair and very professional. And for most of us, he was like a real father, and he was always there for us. We were only allowed to call him Franz after we won the World Cup in 1990.
The big thing to come out of that for me, the discussion of Franz Beckenbauer, is that He only allowed them to call him Franz after they'd won the World Cup.
I love that.
What a detail that is.
I really love that.
Can you imagine going back into the dressing room if you've won the World Cup and you say, cheers, boss, and he goes, call me Franz.
You've earned it.
I wonder also if he... Was he... Was that a thing that he just sprung on them after the World Cup win? Or was that a carrot he dangled?
Yeah, because they almost forgot about the trophy. They were too busy calling Beckenbauer Franz. Making use of their new prize.
So the thing that sort of made me think as well is that, and it doesn't really happen, I might be wrong, but in Europe and in sort of other foreign countries, there's a lot of success stories of genuine playing legends and icons taking over the national team and then doing incredibly well. Whereas in the UK, that just, like, it doesn't happen. And obviously Southgate is in charge now and is doing, you know, a great job.
He's the second most successful England manager of all time. Arguably the most, because he's done it over two tournaments.
Yeah, his record is fantastic. But he wasn't at the level of, say, your Beckenbauers, of your Mateus, of even, say, your Klinsmans. So I was just sort of interested in, like, why there isn't that infrastructure.
Bobby Moore becoming the England manager.
Yes, someone like that. Or even, like, you know, say a Gary Lineker. And I know sort of certain players just aren't interested in management, but it definitely feels like there is more of a sort of system and a process that bloods and then makes. It's like, oh, our best players will become our national team managers at some point.
I totally agree. I think this is the right way.
Well, I think we've discussed this before on the podcast. But we've got to bear in mind that for the first part of last season and the season before, Chris Scull wanted Chelsea to be a success so that Frank Lampard could be a good England manager.
I think
a baffling decision for a West Ham fan.
Well, you're just looking at succession, aren't you? Like, I would actually, I think I may have even said this on here, but give it to Steven Gerrard. Give it to someone at the very top. Do you know what I mean? Like, who understands what it means to play those games?
I just don't feel like the problem is that the players don't understand what it means to play those games. You've got to remember that Steven Gerrard.
Have I got too
failed.
Much of a 90s mentality about this?
Steven Gerrard has failed repeatedly in those games. Do you know? Steven Gerrard has achieved a lot in his career. The one thing he didn't achieve was excellent performances at international tournaments. But I know, I totally agree. But how comfortable would you be if Gareth Southgate leaves and they announce that the next England manager is going to be Terry Butcher?
Yeah, not a great choice, Terry Butcher, admittedly.
All right. But David Beckham, how comfortable are you if they announce the next England manager is David Beckham? Or are you instantly going, well, he's going to be outfoxed by Roberto Mancini? Do you know what I mean? Who's another good example?
Well, that's exactly it.
Although he wasn't a big international player, to be fair to him.
No, but he was a world class player at the time, fantastic player. But it's interesting that there just isn't, and obviously it does happen, but there isn't that same. And I don't know whether that's a damning indictment of sort of the English game at a kind of board level, like the international team and their approach, and especially that old kind of, you know, the reason why Clough didn't get the England job, for example. Is a reason why perhaps great players who would make great managers aren't given the opportunity as well.
But then they did appoint a dangerous choice and he lasted one game. So, you know, were they wrong?
100%
record. 100%
record.
Bring him back.
Bring him back.
Have him finish what he started.
The pint of wine. Now, could we have some... Can we have some mariachi music as we travel back to Mexico, 1986?
Well, I mean, we all knew that Diego was at the peak of his career and had a massive respect. But we were not scared and played a great final. But to be honest, Diego was 1986 unstoppable, and Argentina deserved to win.
Fuller trying to take up a near post position here. Bremer curls it awkward. Oh, it's there! Rudi Fuller! Germany have for life. Rudi Völler keeps up this incredible record. Another corner, another header, and there he was to turn it in. We've talked about this being a 13-man game and energy being important at this stage. You would have thought maybe that a couple of fresh legs would have made all the difference.
He's onside.
Burjaga is blue for Argentina. Can he do it? It's there! Burjaga has made it 3-2. Amazing scenes here.
Don't forget, Germany also lost the final 1982 against Italy. So 1986 was a tough lesson, especially after we had equalized the 2-0 lead of the Argentinians. But this defeat was the foundation of our win 4 years later. So I would say we came back even stronger with the right mentality.
Germany got to the final of Mexico 1986. What I hadn't thought about, in my head, German football is this kind of steamroller of success. But when Germany got to the final of World Cup 90, they were off the back of losing 82 yes. and 86 yeah, in the final, yeah. which I'd never clocked before.
You never think, yeah, didn't think about that.
If they'd lost 1990, they're suddenly like the Jimmy White of World Cups. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's funny how history is so quickly rewritten. And I sort of thought that as well about Italia 90, which he sort of comes to. Because we only know the English prism of those events, you only sort of see like the headlines of the other nations. And I'd love to do a deep dive into Mexico 86 and Euro 88 as well one day on this pod. Because my knowledge starts and ends with Maradona and the hand of God. Like it doesn't extend.
Which is awful for Euro 88 because he wasn't even there. But yeah, I know what you mean. I'd love to know more about those tournaments. Because for me, 1982 is Paolo Rossi, Brazil being really good but not winning it, and then the German keeper knocking the teeth out of a French forward with his arse. Yeah. That's 1982 for me, in a nutshell, really. But you forget that Germany, if you actually think about it, we think about all their victories, but they've had lots of frail periods even in our lifetime.
Yeah, well, interesting. You know, they won Italia 90, and then when it comes to World Cups, didn't win another one until 2014.
That's mad, really, isn't it? And they were bad in USA 94, and they were bad in France 98.
Yeah.
They did get to the final in 2002, and in 82, and in 86. So, you know.
And in 92.
And in 92. Yeah, and they won Euro 96. So actually, it's been pretty impressive. Now, a bit of Ness and Dormer, I suppose, because we come to the real meat of what we wanted to talk to Andy Bremer about, which was Italia 90. But the thing was, when we think about Italia 90, we think about England versus West Germany. But really, before the final, that wasn't Germany's biggest game. Germany's biggest game was their second round game, when, astonishingly, the World Cup favourites and the team that had been to the final in 82 and 86 came up against the Euro 88 champions, Holland, at, of all places, the San Siro. This is Andy's take on that.
This famous round of 16 in San Siro was an amazing match. A packed San Siro where no one was neutral. There were the Germans and the Dutch fans, and there were the Italians, either Inter or AC Milan supporters. So an incredible atmosphere. Frank and Rudi shook hands immediately after the game, and they even made a commercial together after the World Cup. So Rudi is still one of my best friends, and for me, he has one of the best. He is one of the best players on the planet, and due to his hair, he had the nickname in German "Tante Käthe," which is in English "Auntie Kate."
Arguably the biggest game that we haven't given enough credit to in the 90s up until this point?
I thought about that. If you scripted that, it would be unbelievable. You're playing in your home stadium, those six players against each other for your national teams that is arguably for both countries. Well, not arguably, inarguably, the biggest rivalry for both of them.
Yeah, they hate each other, those two teams, don't they?
That's two on the nose. If that wasn't real life, you'd go, oh, come on, this isn't real. And then for that game to be as kind of explosive and incident filled is just amazing.
It's astonishing. Shall we focus on the fact that Rudy Voller's nickname was Auntie Kate? Auntie Kate.
Lovely.
That I love it. People say Germans don't have a sense of humour. What a great nickname.
But I didn't for Rudy Voller. Why?
Because he's got the hair of an auntie. Right? That's what it is, isn't it?
I mean, that's route one. I was like, surely
well, I don't think it is route one because it's a great observation. It's not like you've got the hair of this person. It's you've got the hair. I mean, I might be wrong. Auntie Kate might be a German reference, but to me, it's you've got the hair of a generic auntie with the name Kate.
Yes, it could be Auntie Sharon.
It's a great nickname. It's superb. And it makes me love that German team even more. I also thought it was interesting that we imagine that to be such a high-octane incident, but he points out that Rijkaard and Voller, like, shook hands after the game.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I knew that they had sort of made peace years later because they did do that advert that he mentions. But if someone spat at me in any context, let alone during a football match watched by the most people on the planet at that moment in time, I'm not shaking their hand after the game.
No, absolutely not.
Andy kind of, does he imply there that they get on? That they were quite pally off? Like,
yeah, he implies in the interview also that he gets on really well with these Dutch players.
Yeah.
Which is not what you want, is it?
No.
You want him to go, despised Ruud Gullit. I despised Marco van Basten. I despised Frank Rijkaard. Not, I see them regularly in Lake Gaga.
Yeah.
Lady Gaga. With Lady Gaga. It's a huge fan of 90s film.
What you really want is that they all live on the same sort of street or same gated community. And
well, they did where Andy Gay-Bremer grew up. That was the problem. It wasn't even the best one.
And they're sort of having petty arguments over like wheelie bins and all of that stuff outside of the football. Yeah.
There's three orange houses on one side of the street, three white and black houses on the other side of the street. And the white and black have got that stripe through it, like the German shirt from 1990. Which brings us to, well, probably the most heartbreaking night of the early 90s. England versus West Germany. In Turin. This was Andy's feelings on it.
In the World Cup knockout phase, you take all opponents very serious. We had massive problems in the quarterfinals in the last minutes against Czech Republic. And after the game, Franz shouted at us in the dressing room very loud. And I still get cold sweats thinking about that team talk today. England games are for German teams always great matches. Simply, it's a match of two great football nations. Yeah, I hardly can't remember, but I guess it was my free kick, which was deflected in a very unlucky way. But I guess I will claim it.
Chris, you feel quite strongly about this, don't you?
It's just crushing. I didn't realise it was a one-sided rivalry. It's just disappointing. Specifically the Paul Parker thing. He kind of goes, oh, do you remember, you know, was it your goal? Was it Paul Parker and goal? He's like, what? Do you mean the goal from the free kick in the World Cup semi-final, Andy? Is it because you've done? Because the thing is, he's done so much in his career that this moment that means so much to us means nothing to the guy who was there.
It's like in 30 years, you interview Raheem Sterling for your Danish football podcast, and they go, "Well, obviously, we're going to ask you, was it a penalty in Euro 2020?" He's like, "What?"
Like, was it? Gosh. Yeah.
Can we watch it on YouTube? I don't really remember it.
Who were we playing again? Oh, Denmark. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God.
Dear. You really do think, I guess as an England football fan, you think the world revolves around you and it really doesn't, does it?
No, it really doesn't. But there we go. It went down to a shootout. And once again, we asked the obvious question, which was, did Peter Shilton give you confidence? And this was Andy's take on the England versus West Germany penalty shootout.
For West Germany, it's going to be Bremer. And I take you back to Mexico City in 1985. Shilton was the goalkeeper. It was England against West Germany. Bremer was the penalty taker and Shilton saved it. Can he repeat the feat here? He can't. So 1-1.
We were only focusing on us and ourselves. A penalty shootout is always a very tricky thing. You can't simulate this training since nobody can train the mental pressure and stress after running 120 minutes in a World Cup semi-final. And especially you can't reflect the pressure and all the noise in the stadium. But we had some great penalty shooters in the team and we all felt very confident.
Obviously, England lost that on a shootout. But the penalty we were more interested in was in 1985. Because as you know, over the last few weeks, we've been really obsessing over Peter Shilton and a particular penalty in his career which changed his penalty saving technique, which was when he saved a penalty from Andreas Bremer in 1985 friendly in Mexico when England beat West Germany 3-0. We asked Andy whether this was the most humiliating moment of his career.
So this was a pre-World Cup tournament with Mexico, England and Germany in 1985. I only remember that our entire team got Munzuma's revenge. So it was very difficult to get 11 fit players on the pitch. And in the end, we lost 3-0 to England.
But the only problems apart from that that the Germans have caused has been from long-range shots.
Well, it's a full-back Bremer who's going to take it. Can Shilton hold out? Can England keep their lead? Will it be 1-1? Right on half-time. Bremer with the penalty. And Shilton has saved it! Magnificent by Peter Shilton. And England stay 1-0 in the lead.
Well, what I found interesting about this is, and I don't know whether it's the mentality of sort of winners or players or nations that have won tournaments and competitions and matches where there's no lingering on defeat. Like, it doesn't matter. No. There's no kind of lament. There's no, like, it hasn't affected him in any way. And he's so sort of matter of fact and clinical about everything. And perhaps that's also the German mentality. But it really sort of belittles the status you've given so many of these events.
Well, I tell you what belittles it is that they had the shits. They had Montezuma's revenge, which is the shits. They struggled to get a team together because they all had stomach problems. And that, yet that is the moment that Peter Shilton has used to define his penalty saving. This key moment in Peter Shilton's life came about because Andreas Bremer had been shitting through the eye of a needle. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, and yet Peter Shilton's going around going, I think I've mastered penalties now. I've just saved one from Andy Bremer. I'm going to change everything. And it's going to impact on the Italian 90 World Cup and penalties for the next 5 years. And it turns out, Germany had turned up to this friendly, basically ill, and that was why they lost.
So again, you can trace it back one step. It's a guy who hasn't thoroughly cooked a chicken in Mexico. That's why we didn't win the World Cup in 1990.
I mean, it's been a roller coaster for Peter Shilton this episode, but I'd say
I'm back to hating him.
Re-evaluate. Yeah, I'm back to hating him again. But that obviously isn't the penalty that Andy Bremer is most famous for in his career. That came in the final. So after 85 minutes, Argentina have basically been violent bullies and defensive the whole match. West Germany finally get a penalty. And this is what it is like to take a penalty in the World Cup final.
Lothar did not feel secure. Also, he was supposed to be the shooter. he had the chance. He had to change his shoes at halftime because the sole was broken. And back then, we didn't have four different boots like today. So Lothar had to use an old pair of shoes that he lent to Maradona for a friendly game, and the South American lace their boots in a different way. So he was not comfortable. We just looked at each other, and it was clear for me to take over. It is quite a funny story that Lothar played against Argentina in a World Cup final with a pair of Maradona boots. But the problem was that the Argentina players were delaying the actual penalty by almost 7 minutes by discussing with the referee. And then Rudi Völler came to me and whispered into my ear, listen, if you score, we are world champions. And I said, thank you very much, Rudi. That is the kind of pressure you need. Yeah? But I was not scared. I focused on doing my job and to score the penalty.
There's so much here that I love.
Can just say, yeah, you got to start with Rudi going, score this and we're world champions.
Yeah, come on, Rudi.
Come on, Auntie. Come on, Auntie Kate. Leave off.
Right? Read the fucking room. I know where I am.
The Rudi Völler, score this and we're world champions, isn't astonished. You're a striker, mate. You should be stepping up to take this yourself. Also, the 7 minute delay.
Yeah.
That is intense, isn't it? A 7 minute wait to take a penalty to win the World Cup. But it's always been interesting why Bremer took it rather than Lothar Matthäus, who was the penalty taker. I didn't realise it's because Lothar Matthäus was wearing borrowed boots in the World Cup final.
Not just borrowed. Borrowed from Maradona.
I'd have thought Lothar Matthäus had bigger feet than Maradona.
I was going to say that, yeah. But I couldn't tell whether he... this might not be right, but I think that maybe Matthäus had lent Maradona some boots previously, and Maradona loaning or giving him back the boots that he'd loaned him.
Why has Maradona still got them with him?
How often do they
see? Is it because he's gone to the World Cup and he's gone, oh, I'm actually going to see Lothar Matthäus tonight. I should take those boots that I've got. You know? And you've got someone's jacket and you're going, should I take it? Because he's only going to get lumbered with them then after the game. I don't know whether he'll want them back on tonight.
But so I think they were originally Lothar Matthäus' boots, because he talks about a detail which I was really interested in, which is he says South Americans lace their boots in a different way. Now, like,
what's that?
I mean, I've seen people like wear their Converse differently, but how different can the lacing of a pair of boots be, and how much is it going to impact your ability to strike a ball or take a penalty? Like, what do you think they're doing differently
it's
on the streets
really
of South America?
Weird one, that, isn't
it?
I'd love it if anyone could get some stilled footage of Maradona, or just some photos of Maradona in the late 80s and Lothar Matthäus. Zoom in on the shoes, do send them in, and we'll see what the difference in lacing approach was of Lothar Matthäus and Diego Maradona.
Do you remember that craze in the 90s where people would put like a widget on their trainer? Maybe Maradona had like the top of a beer bottle that he sort of laced through, and that's why he had such good ball control.
That was the secret all along. Obviously then, after Italia 90, it comes to Euro 92 and USA 94. Two tournaments that Germany didn't do particularly well in. This is Andy's take on them.
And Kohler was a bit overconfident. Yes! Jensen! John Jensen has finally got one right! And Denmark have struck first in the 19th minute. Oh, and Christensen kicked out then. This is Vilfort! Oh, it's in! It is in! And it's Kim Vilfort! Going to have to endure another free kick. No, it is over! Denmark's dream has become reality. A quite astonishing achievement. The rank outsiders who didn't even qualify have become the champions of Europe, undisputed. Denmark have done it. They are the 1992 European champions. It is simply a footballing fairy tale.
I was even captaining our team since Lothar was not taking part to ligament injury. When we then also lost Rudy to an injury, we really suffered from the loss of these two players. The team and also myself, I did not have the best day in the final, and the Danish were just in incredible condition, so they really deserved the title.
Kiryakov, neat turn by him, and Lechkov going in, and it's another one! Bulgaria are in front, Lechkov! From villain to hero, the man who gave away the penalty has now struck so decisively at the other end. It was a brilliant header then, Yakov with the cross, and look how Lechkov has sneaked in front of Hessler. A marvellous header, and suddenly the game has turned around.
I mean, I was already playing during the Olympic tournament in LA in 1984. The stadiums were huge, but the atmosphere was strange. I still remember the incredible heat since we had to play at noon. The team was on paper very strong, but we were not one unit, which you could see at the end on the pitch.
I mean, Euro 92, obviously the forgotten tournament for England. Quite a strange tournament for Germany. Do you remember, like, watching that final?
No, I remember not watching it.
I remember Schmeichel being amazing in it, and I'm willing to say that, Michael.
I remember being outside playing football whilst it was on and then coming in to find out the result. But I recently was watching clips and highlights of that final, and the shithousing from the Danes, the back pass,
really?
The back pass.
The plucky Danes. No, I've seen a supercut of that. It's crazy.
The ball will go to Schmeichel, and obviously he will just keep it at his feet, crouched over, ready to pick it up, and we'll just wait.
So is this pre-back
pass? This is pre-back pass, and I think this game was arguably the biggest reason why it was implemented, because they basically...
I thought it came in earlier.
It was possibly being discussed, but I think this definitely was the tipping point, because they pass it back to Schmeichel, and he just keeps it at his feet and just waits for the German player to come onto them. He picks it up. He will then roll it out to another defender to the side of the box, who will then, rather than play an attacking ball forward, will play it back to Schmeichel, and he'll pick it up again. And there are passages of play where he does that like several times in a row before booting it up the field. It's one of the worst games of football I've ever seen.
Wow, because in your mind, the Danes are like this amazing, happy, plucky team that have been added to the tournament late. But it turns out they're actually, you know, I mean, I suppose it's a bit like when Greece won Euro 2004, and it's like, yeah, but they didn't do it in this glorious way. The underdog doesn't necessarily like win it in a Hollywood manner.
I think you'd be hard pressed if you watched the whole game to come out of it going, oh yeah, I'm glad the Danes won. If anything, you're rooting for the Germans by the end of it.
Do you remember Germany going out of USA 94?
Yeah, that felt like a massive deal at the time.
It did feel like a huge deal, didn't it? Because they went out in the quarters to Bulgaria. And it felt...
Yes.
I didn't watch it, but I remember finding out the news. I was on the Tamar ferry between... Cornwall and Devon, coming back from seeing my half siblings, and I remember it being on the radio, and it like blew my mind.
Yeah,
because that just didn't happen. Germany losing to someone who they weren't meant to lose at in the quarterfinals.
I also think at that point in my life, I just was so unaware of Bulgaria as a country or a place. This was probably the first time I'd ever heard of them. So it was like, what, they've lost to, like, that might as well be Qatar. They've lost us like a regional team, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah. Do you know what? As well, that game, I don't know if you remember watching it. Bulgaria scored two goals in really quick succession. I think they were 1-0 down, and Bulgaria come back. So it was real drama. But the other thing that happened on that day is that even to this day, in the back of my mind, I will think Bulgaria are a world class team because of that win. Like forever, I think Bulgaria are a team to fear.
Yeah, they're dangerous.
They're dangerous. Like because of that one day.
I'm surprised you haven't written off Hristo Stoichkov because he won the Ballon d'Or. We always end with, well, Chris, you always ask the same question at the end. Would you like to ask it of Andy Bramer?
If you had the opportunity to go back in time to the 1st of January 1990 and do it all again, would you, Andy?
No, not at all. I do not regret anything and would do everything the same way. And I'm very grateful what football has given me and the people that I worked with and what I could have learned in my career.
And no is the answer there. No.
He seems like a very content man. Someone that has no regrets, that sort of is very, very happy with what he's done. And I really admire that.
Yeah, I think there's something great about, I mean, obviously it's easy to have no regrets when you've had his career. But I think I love that when you meet a footballer who just goes, kind of, what an amazing thing to have happened to me almost. And they're just really happy with how their career went.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really feel that often when we interview these players, they've got a sense of perspective on it because there's a distance now to their careers.
Yeah.
Where it's like, just an amazing adventure that you don't realise you're on probably at the time.
And also, what I find is that the guys like Andy, and Gary Neville said this as well, the guys that were at the very top generally don't want to live it again because it was such an intense period. They had to operate at the very height of existence almost, like the intensity of being under that amount of pressure for that long. They don't want it again. They're happy with what they did.
I totally agree. And that's why I'm sure all three of us would happily go back to 1990 because we haven't been operating at those levels. it was a genuine pleasure to get Andy Bramer to answer our questions. Thank you so much to him and his agent, Philip, for doing that for us because they could have easily at any point told us to F off and they'd have been well within their rights.
Well, there was a point when I was arranging an international bank transfer and I thought, is this our Ali Dyer? Are we getting absolutely scammed here by someone?
Are we getting absolutely scammed? For, let's be honest, less money than Andy Bramer should be being paid for the interview. we've been catfished by Andy Bramer. Is this not Andy Bramer on Instagram? It's a man who poses at him in the hope that foreign football podcasts will pay him quite a measly sum to answer some questions.
Imagine if he said when he took the penalty, if he'd answered like Peter Shilton when it came to saving penalties, and Andy Bramer said, when you're taking a penalty, go make sure you lead with your head and your foot. Andy, we've caught you out. You're not the real Andy.
What do you think would have happened if Bramer's technique was to wait until the goalkeeper had moved and Shilton's was to wait until the penalty taker had... they'd still be there now.
Thank you to Andy. Thank you to Philip. If you are a footballer who is second language English, but would be happy to answer questions in that long form, we will accept you as a guest on this show, presuming you've won at least one World Cup. Thank you very much. I think we've learned a lot about Andy Bramer, a lot about German football that we didn't know. Most of all, let us all remember that from now on, Rudi Völler will be nicknamed Auntie Kate. There we go. Have we just got time for the quiz?
Yeah, why not?
Quick quiz. We've been sent one in. So here we go. This week's quiz is from Sam King. Are you two up for playing this?
Yep.
Yes.
Hi, chaps. Hope all is well. I have a quiz that you can play at the end of the upcoming episode. It's simple and hopefully fun. 8 quotes. 4 from Sir Alex Ferguson. 4 from Benito Mussolini. All Chris and Michael have to do is figure out who said which one? 4 each. Do you want to go first or second?
I'll go first.
Quote number 1. Once you bid farewell to discipline, you say goodbye to success.
That's got to be Mussolini.
Ferguson or Mussolini?
That's got to be Mussolini.
Incorrect. It's Ferguson. Oh. The hard part is to keep people at the window because of the spectacle you put on for them. And you must do this for years. Ferguson or Mussolini, Michael?
I'm going to say Mussolini.
Correct. 1-0 to Michael. Journalism is not a profession, but a mission.
Mussolini.
Correct. 1-1. Once you shake hands with the devil, you have to accept they are in control.
I think that sounds like something Fergie would say about agents, so I'm going to say Fergie.
Correct. 2-1. I've got a temper if I need it. Nothing wrong with losing your temper if it's for the right reasons.
I mean, on the face of it, that's definitely Ferguson, so I'm going to say Ferguson.
Correct. It's 2-2. Michael with a quote in hand. This is the epitaph I want on my tomb. Here lies one of the most intelligent animals who ever appeared on the face of the earth.
Well, I can't imagine Fergie saying tomb, so I'm going to say Mussolini.
It's 3-2 to Michael. Oh. Chris, you need this.
Yeah, this needs to go in.
I remember the first time... I remember the first time I saw Ryan Giggs play. He was 13 and floated over the ground like a cocker spaniel chasing a piece of paper in the wind.
Yeah, I don't know if you know, Chris, Mussolini used to be our head scout, just in case you need that info.
Fergie?
Correct. It's 3-0, Michael, to win this. I've been a racist since 1921. Fergie's not Mussolini to win it.
Well, I'm tempted to get it wrong for the draw, but I also don't want to libel Alex Ferguson.
So yeah, I'm going to say
Mussolini.
Handshakes all around. Well done.
You win. Thank you, everyone, for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure. What a guest to have on. What a further chapter to the Peter Shilton story. Let's be honest. It's a glorious period for Quickly Kevin at the moment, and it's a pleasure to be a part of it. Michael, how would you like to end the episode?
I think there's only one way. I'm going to play us out with the German national anthem.
Until next time, Robbie Slater. See you later.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.